Hello, and welcome to Living Vertical Radio, where we change the narrative of media by introducing you to creative and innovative individuals that inspire you with their unique stories. Our host is C. Steen Duckworth, and you can call in or Skype into this program by calling 1-646-668-2928 #1. Please make sure your surrounding area is quiet because this is a live program. One Sure Sign Mobile Notary of Frisco, Texas provides professional notary service across the Dallas metro area. Our notary professionals are ready to help you with loan closings, power of attorney, fingerprinting, and other notary services. We meet you at your location of choice, your home, office, hospital, or local coffee shop, convenient to your schedule. Reliable, professional, and affordable. One Sure Sign is happy to support Living Vertical Radio here in Texas. Mention you heard this ad on Living Vertical for $5 off any notary service. Interested in advertising on our podcast with a listening audience of over 800,000? You can do a 15-second business ad, a 30-second radio ad, or a 10-minute interview radio ad. Our prices start out at $50. Contact us at info@verticalmediagroup.com. Our pricing is made to give everyone the ability to advertising no matter the budget. Thank you. And here's your host, C. Steen Duckworth.
Good morning, everyone. This is Celeste Duckworth, and I am your host for A Taste of Ink Live. I hope everyone is doing well today. We're having a little hot, muggy day in Arizona. Before we get to our guest today, who is E.T. Gunnarsson, a young author, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy this program today. But today I have another announcement to make before we invite you to take time out for the experience, the landscape, the art, the people, the story. Oh, we're doing a writer's retreat in Ireland, and we're doing it in our favorite place, Tullamore, Ireland, which is in County Offaly. We've had a lot of friends there, and actually the city of Chandler, Arizona is their sister city. So we're planning a great getaway, and this is for authors. Our facilitator is going to be Jackie Shelton Green, who is the North Carolina Poet Laureate. So this is a retreat for authors to go and relax and enjoy the scenery, and just get, you know, just freshen up your muse a little bit, okay? The trip is going to cost $26.99. The space is limited. We're not taking a big group. It's going to be from May 26, 2022 to June 6, 2022. There's a $200 deposit. You can pay your payments out. More information is found at verticalalliance.com/vertical-creative-ventures. And vertical, just for everybody to know, it's spelled with a K, but you'll see us promoting this a lot on our social media, you know, as we go and as we get closer. And let's hope that we're all doing better in this pandemic that we're having. So it's far enough ahead, so we're keeping our fingers crossed. So now let's get to our program. E.T. Gunnarsson, he is an 18-year-old post-apocalyptic thriller author. He grew up on a horse rescue ranch in Rocky Mountains of Colorado, and he is at home online schooler and will soon pursue online college. He has a purple belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, a brown belt in judo, and trained with the judo and Greco-Roman wrestling Olympic teams at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. I'm excited to bring you here today to meet him because he just wrote a great book called Forgive Us, and it's his first book. He has another book called Abandon Us, the prequel to Forgive Us, that's scheduled to come out in early 2022. So let me tell you a little bit about the book. It is the winner of the 2021 San Francisco Book Festival Science Fiction Award. And that's why I'm just so excited to have him here. Young man, 18 years old. God, what a great achievement, right? And just what a great achievement to hear about with our authors that are up and coming. wow, great achievement. Doesn't mean that you can write a book. I know people come and say, oh, I want to write a book. And I'm like, just write it. So today we're going to talk to E.P. Gunnarsson. We're going to find out what was his inspirations, a little bit about him as an author, and also a few little quirky questions that we might have him too. So welcome, E.P. Welcome to our program. I hope you're doing fine today.
I'm doing great. Thank you for inviting me on.
Yes, we're excited to have you on. I did read through the book. I'm a sci-fi lover, and I really loved it. So I'm excited to be able to also, for our fans listening out there, I have a copy, have a couple of copies to give away if you contact me. So, E.P., tell me about growing up on a horse ranch. What's that like?
It was interesting. We lived, like, really far away from, like, civilization. Like, we were 40 minutes away from shopping. And it was interesting, you know, a big property, lots of things to do. And you always got to see, like, the best and worst in people. Like, rescuing horses, you get to see the worst in people when they come. And then you get to see the best in people when those horses get adopted and they go to good homes and stuff. So it was interesting. Luckily, since I was young, I didn't really get to see all the bad stuff. But all the good stuff I really got to see. And it's amazing to see, like, horses bounce back and become healthy and be happy and stuff. And I think that's always the best thing with, like, rescue animals. Like, we had a rescue mastiff who was blind because he was malnourished, and he was the most loving dog ever. You could do anything to him. He would never be aggressive. He was a very, very good dog. I still miss him.
That really sounds like a great atmosphere to grow up in. To be able to manage horses, and then just being in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado, that's the inspiration right there.
Oh, yeah, it's like Middle Earth.
Yeah, it is like Middle Earth. You're right. So what is the inspiration behind? Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say I woke up every morning and had, like, Pikes Peak out the window. So that was a good part about Colorado.
I can relate about that. I went to school in northern Arizona in Flagstaff, so I used to wake up and see the San Francisco Peak. So I can relate to that. That is such a calming, it's a calming way to wake up in the morning. It really is, you know, to be able to see something like that. Yeah, for sure. So I'm sure a lot of your inspiration and I have to make a note here is that you love Norse mythology, which I love all mythology. So that's a great indicator of inspiration right there. But tell me what inspired you to write this science fiction book.
So Forgive Us was really inspired off of years of experiencing post-apocalyptic fiction through games and stuff. So the major inspirations for Forgive Us are, like, the Fallout series or Mad Max, or one of my really, like, subconscious ones was, what's the name of it? WALL-E. WALL-E was a huge inspiration for Forgive Us. The polluted world, the world covered in trash that, like, WALL-E lived in. That's how Forgive Us kind of is, with trash everywhere and stuff. And the next book, Remember Us, Abandon Us, the prequel to Forgive Us, you know, really shows this kind of inspiration of this trash-covered world, the pollution and stuff. But Forgive Us is more like, you know, wasteland environment. It's, you know, there's a big polluted haze, the world's dark. So WALL-E is one of the big inspirations. The Fallout series, certainly. And then there are, like, little inspirations in between, many of which I can't really recall now. Really just things like, oh, I need an idea for this, so I'll go study it. And then I'll learn something really, really interesting, and then I won't use it ever again, and I forget it.
Okay.
Well, I learned how to make air wells one time. And then I don't remember how to do it anymore. Which an air well is like essentially a dew collector. It collects condensation.
Right. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I like this is what's really interesting about your book, too. I mean, your book it wasn't the same as some apocalyptic post-apocalyptic stories, which where I mean that it's just such a really sterile type of a writing. Yours had some really had characters that you really could connect with. And even though, you know, you're talking about it's set, you know, nearly 100 years in the future, there were some things that you could really, and this is what I love about people that do games and whatnot. There were some things that really you're looking at and you're like, oh, gosh, you know, that could really happen. So, you know, how did you form your character? What was character development like for you? Because I'll tell you, I liked London, and I really did like, I could really relate to Oliver as well.
So character development for me is not necessarily complex. The characters kind of just come out. I sort of in my head have some presets, like the main character for Forgive Us, Oliver, and the main character of my next book, whose name I won't tell yet, are kind of the same in the way that they're just on different sides of history. So mm-hmm. when I write them, I sometimes will write the other one's name. But when I really make characters, it's generally an inspiration. Like the story of London and Rose was inspired from something called the datification of games, which is essentially game companies keep the same developers for a while. And like, you know, uh-huh. 90s games and early 2000s games. And then eventually, as the company grows and computer like games grow, so do the developers, and they become fathers and stuff. So they uh-huh. reflect that in their games. So there's a lot of like father figures in games. So London was kind of inspired off of that. He's that kind of like Last of Us, like Joel, or The Walking Dead season one by Telltale, like Lee, like that just kind of dad. So that's, they just appear. Like when I write the character, I kind of just have an idea of who they are. I just make mm-hmm. a preset in my head, like a class, like a game, like in a, like World of Warcraft, you have like classes, like you can play mm-hmm. as a warlock or something like that.
Right,
so that carries
right.
a theme. So they're the themes. Like Simon has a theme. Oliver has a theme. So does London Rose. Like all the characters have themes of who they are. Kind of like a, I guess, they're written through a stereotype and become a person.
Right, right.
And I really try that with my characters. I really try and make them people. Recently, mm-hmm. I received a 4-star review on my book, and the only complaint the person had was swearing. And I was kind of shocked because I didn't swear like every page, but I did have characters swear.
Right.
I usually have them swear for like a reason, like they hurt themselves or something terrible's happening.
Right.
Like I really mm-hmm. think genuine, real people like swear, and I try and make these characters genuine. If I don't quite remember, but I think in Forgive Us, I tried my absolute hardest not to include words like raiders or bandits or anything like that that alienates a group. Because in the Wasteland, like everyone's a survivor. Everyone's hungry. It's not evil.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, in games like Fallout, like you have factions and then you have the raiders, just unknown groups of people who, you know, like they're just evil
mm-hmm.
and you can get them. But that's not really how the real world works. People are hungry, they do things for a reason. You know, they are living things that want things, you know. So they're not
mm-hmm.
they're not evil, they don't do it out of malice, they just do it, you know.
And you know, I love your perspective because that's one was when you said that game developers become father. That's really just a concept you don't really think about when you're doing games. My son is a huge gamer, and we talk a lot about games. And so that's an interesting perspective that you just gave me there. Also, it's funny, you know, it's funny that someone says, you know, complained about the swearing because I didn't think there was much swearing in your book. And maybe it's because I kind of see it like you do, that these were real people, you know, in a real situation, this would be real people. I mean, it's not, you know, these are things that people go through. And like you said, yeah, they swear. Like my kids tell me not to swear because they said I don't know how to swear. But
I know my fair share of swearing.
So, you know, so that was just a great perspective. So, and just your reasoning behind your characters, I think that's very, very perceptive of you in that manner. So how did was there any part of the book when you were writing it, was there any part of it when you, because we're talking about, you know, individuals that read your book. So when you wrote this book, who were you writing it to? Who were you thinking your audience would be?
I don't think I really thought of an audience. I was just writing something in my head. Like, it's, I think the audience is kind of like really like people who like the games I like Fallout and stuff. It's a few things. Like, forgive us the, like, there's many kinds of like apocalypses. There's zombie apocalypse, nuclear apocalypse. I wanted Forgive Us to be unique in that it's a pollution apocalypse. So I think it's just like the audience is people who like post-apocalyptic fiction, but are extremely bored of what they already have.
Okay.
So that's what that's what I wrote. Mm-hmm. That's what I wrote the series to be: something unique, something different, you know, something more real and visceral and stuff like that. So I wasn't really writing it to somebody. Of course, what helps me write is just knowing that somebody's gonna read it. Like my dad, you know, he reads all my stuff, and like, it's helpful to know that, oh, I'm going to make this, and somebody I really, really, really trust is going to look over it and be like, yes, no, yes, 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 no, 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 yes, yes, you know.
Okay. All right. So let me ask you, so, you know, it does, reading Forgive Us makes you think about quite a few things. So one of them is, part of it is what happens between humanity when you're living in this type of environment, especially when you're talking about the impact of pollution and what's going on with the planet now. So when you were writing it, did you want them to be able to at some point come together and work together to something better?
Are you saying that, like, have the characters unite to, like,
yes,
you know, make a better society and stuff?
Yes, absolutely.
Kind of towards the end, like, New York, like, it's kind of that, but not really. It's just, like, these are, like, the wasteland, there's a lot of free space, and then there are people claiming it and building something. And, of course, they don't repeat the mistakes of the past. Like, of course, ignium is not used again. That pollutes an energy source. It's replaced by electricity, going back in time a little bit. And, you know, like, they still repeat the same mistakes. They still fight. They still have war, but it's just a little different because it's a different world. Reason I call it the New World is because it's an entirely different world from us. Like, you know, it's like a European forest versus an American forest. The European forest has nice moss and mushrooms and nice birds and stuff. And then every American forest seems to want to kill you with rattlesnakes and boars and bears, and everything's pokey and sharp. It's just, they didn't, it's not really like a unification thing. It's just like the eventuality, like, there was a chance that Patria, the the opposite of New York, could have won and ruled over the wasteland, and then there was a chance that New York could have done it, and turns out New York came on top. So it's just all chances and what's happening and that sort of stuff. It just falls together.
Okay. So, you know, I want to know also, you know, in the book, you talk, it demonstrates tyranny and what it's like to live under tyranny. What type of research did you do when you were coming up with, you know, this particular perspective in the book?
I didn't actually have to do a lot of research as I was writing it because I did a lot of research of it in the past. Like, a lot of games have tyrants, and then there's tyrants in real life. Like, for example, in high school, in English class, I had to make a presentation about one of the books I read. Well, that book was The Hunger Games, and I did a presentation comparing the tyrannical government in The Hunger Games to that of North Korea. I'm also a very, like, hugely interested in World War II, so obvious tyrannical references there, so... I don't know, just kind of came to me. Like I've seen so much of that, like kind of like experienced so much of that information that, you know, it's just something I want to like show other people, you know, like living, living in Patria is really, really tough. Like it is like living in Rome when it was like, what's the word? An autocracy when it was under like Caesar and stuff. Like, it's a tough time because the government does not care about you, the individual. It just wants to use you as a tool. So the Patria is the same way. Like everyone there, there's no individual rights. There's no free speech or anything like that. There is, you are going to go do what your superiors say, and we're all going to do what the great leader says. You're going to, if we're going to build a road, you're going to help build a road. And it doesn't matter what you think. So in New York, the fate of the individual is self-decided. If you want to be a trader, you could go be a trader. If you want to go work with caravans, you can go work with caravans. You can go be a farmer. You can actually buy private property, all that kind of stuff from the New York government, of course. But in Patria, it is, we are a legion. We are all one. Like, we all work together to do this one thing, which has its benefits. It has negative sides. One of the negative sides is a lot of people die. A lot of people die. So, yeah.
So, you show an example about that anyone can be turned into a, you know, unfeeling person. And that dehumanization is the easiest way to allow the mind to kill. So, thinking about that thought there, do you think in the same way a person that has become an unfeeling monster, can they possibly change from an experience?
Yes, I think they do. It's I imagine it would be if, like, for example, Oliver is from the old world, so he is I didn't quite write this very well because I didn't know it very well when I first wrote it, but he is, you know, ridden with PTSD. He has seen things, like he's seen what he knows fall apart. Like right now, we have a society, people take out garbage, we pay taxes, people build roads for us. And then having, like, you can go to the grocery store and go get whatever food you want to buy, right, with paper. But he's seen all of that just get lost. Like, he can't go to the grocery store. He can't, like, he's lost his family. He's lost everything. So he's become numb. And then just, like, moments in his life where he has to do what he needs to do to survive. Like, even if it's disgusting or if it's cruel or if, like, merciless, like, he still kind of has some feeling in the beginning of the book, and then that slowly dissipates when he finally gets something of value to him, which is that bunker where Patria starts from. That's something extremely valuable to him because that guarantees that he won't starve tomorrow. So when he gets that, he slowly becomes unfeeling. So becoming feeling again requires humanity. It's typically in my writing, it would probably be a pretty traumatic display of just pure innocent, like, human, like something like a child with their their deceased mother or something like that. Something really shocking. The character's like, oh my god, what am I doing right now? Something like that.
Okay. Well, I want to ask you now about, we're going to talk about your dysgraphia. I thought that, you know, hearing that you had dysgraphia, and for those of you that are listening, and we'll have E.T. tell us more about it, and being able to do this book, this really, it was really inspiring for me. I know I don't know anyone with dysgraphia, but I do have friends that are dyslexic that I helped when I was in college. Tell us what dysgraphia is like.
So dysgraphia is like, it's categorized as like a learning disability, and there's like different forms of it, of course. I have a pretty mild form where it's extremely difficult to put thought on paper. Like, I can't write. Like, when you write your name, you do it in, like, the same kind of line. I can't do that. And I find it, like, painful to write with my hands, especially now that I'm developing a lot of hand damage from the sport I do. It's just difficult. And also, like, interestingly enough, I can spell words, like complex words, with my keyboard easily. I don't even think about it. Most of these words, I don't really know how to spell. I can just do it. But when it comes to writing, since it's so slow, I have to think about each letter I put down. I sometimes struggle to like write the word photosynthesis, even though I really know how to write that word. I can do that without thinking on my keyboard, but I can't do it with a pencil. Other people, you know, they have a hard time learning. It's, you know, it's just, it's a learning disability, and it's usually involving 10%. And I can't do that very well. I can do it, like, write kind of well with one alphabet, but of course, since that's not the alphabet I grew up with, I just have a hard time writing that too. So it's just, for me, I can't use pencils and pens. It's annoying, it's slow, it's painful, it's hard, I can't think. So, you know, so it gets in the way.
How long did it take you to write the book? Because I'm like, even listening to you talk about what this, you know, what dysgraphia is, and so I'm like, how long did it take you to write Forgive Us?
Well, I didn't do it by hand. I did it with a keyboard, which allowed me to do it maybe in a year, and then it took me another year to edit it. So writing on the keyboard, really easy PC for me. Like my latest book, it took me like 6 months to finish. And that's all with a keyboard. It's all just adapting to something that's easier, which is, for me, computers, screens, keyboards, mouses, all that kind of stuff, which is way easier in my opinion. Like editing, I can just delete a word and retype it if I want to. Can't do that with a piece of paper.
That's true. I had someone tell me once, I got so used to doing computers. I've been on computers all my life. And I'm so used to doing computers, and someone would say, oh, you need to just start writing this. And I thought to myself, write it? I mean, on pencil and paper. And I was like, okay, because, you know, I started out as a programmer, and I've always been on the computer. So it was just like just much more easier for me. But also, you just said you did your own editing?
Yeah.
Wow. What was that like?
Yes. Well, you go through it, and then you read it, and then you're either like, oh, this is fine, or this is horrible, I need to fix it. Or this sounds weird, or that's misspelled, or I could say that better. It's a slow process.
Did you use any type of grammar type checker or anything like that?
I have the premium version of Grammarly, which helps, but that's really for me to figure out, like, things are really subtle in English language, like passive voice, which I don't fully have in my head, so I use like Grammarly to help me out. But when it comes to rewriting sentences and that kind of stuff, I don't really use it.
Huh?
I only use it to make sure things are right.
Okay. Well, that's very cool. I'm even more impressed that you did your own editing as well. So
I did have an editor.
Okay, great.
The way it goes is me, my dad, then me again, then an editor, then maybe a second editor.
Okay, well that's good. I had to laugh because I remember when I did my first book, my creative you had to submit to be in a creative writing group, and the teacher said to me, "Oh, it's a great story," said, "but your grammar is awful," And he said, but just keep writing the story. So I remember about 10 years ago, I pulled the old manuscript out, and I was kind of going through it, and I was like, oh, my God, my grammar was horrible.
When I was younger, I had horrible grammar, or just the way a sentence came out was terrible. Like, rereading Forgive Us is just a pain, because it's just an older way of writing for me that isn't me anymore. So it's just like, oh, this is terrible. Why do people like this?
Right. Okay. So going forward, now we're working on Abandon Us. How close are you to having that one done?
It is done. Like all the pages are finished. Everything has been edited by me and my father. Now it's out with an editor who will eventually return it to me in like maybe a month or so. And then that should guarantee time for me to be able to publish it next year.
Okay. before we move forward, tell our fans where they can find Forgive Us right now and where they can find you. Any fan pages?
So the best way to find me is either on Instagram or Facebook. You can either follow me on like Braggy Press, which is my company, or you can follow me on like E.T. Gunnarsson if you look up E.T. Gunnarsson. The best place to find my book is on Amazon. If you look up Forgive Us by E.T. Gunnarsson, you'll find it on Amazon. And then, of course, you can find it on Barnes & Noble's and all that sort of stuff. And then if you prefer audiobooks, you can find my book, the audio version of my book, on Amazon or Audible.
Wow, you've been really busy with this book. And when you said, because I did see it on audiobook, and I'm like, wow, you're really busy with getting this book out. So as, you know, all this work for yourself and the things that you've done for this book, would you say that some of it was a little bit overwhelming putting it together? Were there any things that you felt was more of a challenge than anything else than just doing the book and getting the book out?
The main challenge of getting this book out was understanding how to actually get a book out, because
yeah.
You know, when I finished it, I was like, okay, I did it. This is great.
Right.
I, in fact, had not done it because it had to be edited, which was a trial on its own, and then it had to be given a good cover and then a good Amazon description, and then it has to have advertisements, and it has to, you know, you have to go find people to review and all that sort of stuff. So it's just the main difficulty of publishing Forgive Us was learning how to actually publish a book and get it out there. And, of course, there's
okay.
a lot of mistakes on the way. I published it on the wrong day and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah.
Well, it's great presentation. And who did the cover for your book?
Oh, I don't remember. One second. I got to ask. Essentially, the way we did the covers, we had an artist do the very first cover on, I believe, was it Readsy? It's one of the sites where you can hire people to do things for you, like Photoshop and stuff. I forgot the name though, which bugs
okay.
me now.
All right.
I should remember that.
It wasn't Fiverr, was it?
It was Fiverr. Yes, the very first one was Fiverr.
All right. Great.
And then we had an artist on Readsy, I believe, do a second version, which was way better because he actually drew it. And then the final version, which is the version everyone can get now, was done through a competition on something called 99 Designs, where essentially, I believe we put like a prompt up and then gave people some ideas and then just waited for people to submit their designs. So we had like hundreds of designs, and whoever would win would get money, right? Get a little prize. So we just had somebody design on 99 Designs, and you know, we had a lot of designs and had to choose. Oh yes, the person is named Zealous on 99 Designs. Zealous.
Well, I like that idea though of getting people to, you know, do a prompt and getting people to, send in their ideas. I like that idea.
Yeah, the best in people seem to, for like covers and stuff, the best in people seem to come out like with competition.
I think so too.
So for anybody who's trying to get cover, I recommend that.
So now you're a published author, and you've gone through the challenges and and whatever you consider the success of publishing. So I always ask authors as they go through their learning period as a writer, what type of advice would you give an up and coming writer that you felt was important to you to learn?
And there's a few lessons. First of all, you actually have to write. Like, you have to have the discipline to put your words on paper. And I read this very good book called, what's the name? The War on Arts, which basically creates this antagonist. It creates an idea of antagonist called resistance, which is the reason you procrastinate. It stops you from doing
okay.
things. Like, oh, mm-hmm. I'm going to exercise today, but I can go and watch TV instead. And that's resistance telling you that you shouldn't do that. So
right.
really, like, one of the major things is overcoming resistance. Like, don't skip out on writing. Like, writing is a job. Like, if you want to do it, like, spend some time on it. Like, make a schedule. Like, oh, I'm going to put an hour on this, every day and every week. Like, an hour a day, right? That's it. Or 30 minutes a day. Like, whatever works for you, you know? So the first part is, like, discipline. The second part, you have to learn how to actually publish a book, which, you know, there's lots of resources online to teach you how, like, you know, how to do advertisements, how to do covers, what's important. Like, for example, what's extremely important is good ads and good Amazon blurbs. That's really, okay. really important. And then third thing, I would say get an editor, because writing, like my book became a lot better after an editor. Like I, you know, I edit pretty okay, but like after it went through my editor, Allison Rolfe, who I think is on Reezy, it was just a whole different book, a whole different experience. I really recommend an editor, like somebody who understands writing and fiction and that all that kind of stuff. Having somebody like that see your work before it comes out will really improve it.
You know, I'm glad you said that, and that's definitely one that we'll be putting out there when we share on our social media and we share in our magazine as well, because I don't think, you know, a lot of individuals that are writing, I don't think they understand how important an editor can just reframe your book and make it even more so what you thought it was, and it's all in the editing after it's done. So I really like to hear what you're saying there, because it really does make a difference to have someone, you know, do that last edit. So you also had to learn how to do your marketing as well, right?
My dad sort of helped me on that, but
Your dad did? Okay,
intensely.
All right.
We both kind of did it, but it's intensely frustrating to do marketing. Like, it's subtle things with ads. Like, we have ads for my audiobook, of course, and like recently it had stagnated. And then my dad checked out the ad that wasn't working very well, and realized that it had linked to the completely wrong page for my book. And then after fixing that, we got a sales record. It's just like marketing is difficult. It's subtle, and for anybody who wants to like market their book and stuff, like, I really recommend go look at online sources and go learn how to do it. It takes a week, right? And just take a week out of your life, go like learn how to do it, and that will help you tremendously.
Yes, it will. And even you know, and I will say, even authors that I've talked to that are have been picked up by, I would say, the large traditional publishing houses will say the same thing. They say they spend at least 35% of their time is marketing, you know, which is huge. But, you know, I understand it's huge, but I like what you said, too, about take a week off and learn marketing, because that's so crucial for your book and for you to be, you know, to get your book out there as well. You know, you mentioned at the beginning that, you know, reading some of the reviews, how much importance do you put into the reviews that people come back with after reading your book?
Most reviews I get are pretty, like, not to brag, but most reviews I get are pretty good. Some of them have interesting criticism, not like a lot of like really large criticism. For example, a few people didn't like that I included a sentence pointing out the time shifts in the book, where like, oh, 54 years later or 100 years earlier, that kind of stuff. But I did that early on because some people got confused on what the times were in the book, even though each chapter began with a timestamp. So I did that so people would realize, oh, this is a time shift, like an actual time shift. That little number on the chapter is actually like the actual time of the what's happening, you know. So that's I mean, there's some reviews you get where I have like one 2-star review and one 3-star review, And essentially, it's just them clicking the stars and not giving any feedback. So I was like, all right, that's a waste of time. Like, they didn't say anything. So
that's just,
I don't care. I really don't care. And I don't know. Reviews are important. Like a friend of mine told me, I'm not going to buy your book until you get at least like 10 reviews. And I was like, first of all, you're a jerk. Second of all, I have 40 reviews.
Right.
So reviews are important. Like I do recommend, like it's a little weird, but like, you know, go out and ask people to review your book. Like every time you give somebody a book, tell them, review my book. Like, please. But don't put too much emotional investment in it, because it's not you. It's you know, like I find that a lot of like negative criticism is not really that great. You know, it's just something kind of picky. But it's important. You know, you need it. But don't be emotional about it. Be like a Star Trek Vulcan. Like, don't think with your heart. Think with your brain.
Don't think so hard. I like that.
Don't think so. Like don't sit at night and be like, oh, darn it. Like, no.
Right.
It doesn't matter. Just keep walking forward. Like, then everyone is eventually going to get like sunk under like other reviews. So it doesn't matter.
Right. I was encouraging when we were, you know, kind of like in lockdown, you know, last year, and I was still doing our program, and authors usually send me two books to give away. And so it was a lot of fun because I was in communication with my neighborhood, and I would say, hey, I got, you know, got a new book here. And so I was doing the deliver the book and put it on your porch thing last year. So when people said they wanted to, you know, read, they wanted to read, you know, new authors. And so I was thinking, how weird is this, delivering it with my mask and everything and putting it, you know, in their carport or whatever. But it's been a lot of fun. And my neighborhood, you know, they're always asking me, well, who's new out? And which I think is fun because I'm the type of reader that will kind of read a book I like, and I'll keep reading whatever that author puts out. And usually for me to read something new, someone says, here's a book you want to read. And then I, you know, end up something new. So I'm really going to, there's a lot of sci-fi fans in my neighborhood, and I'm really excited about getting those two books that you have to them. So one of the things that I like to ask a few quirky questions for my guests, for my audience, loves it. So I hear that you love performance cars. What kind of performance cars?
Cars. I love American V8s, and I love V8 engines in general. So my favorite cars have to be like muscle cars of the 70s, or even modern muscle cars. Even though there's only Dodge makes muscle cars nowadays, but my really really big favorite performance car right now is the Corvette, which is, in my opinion, is the best American performance car because it's like not too expensive, it's aerodynamic, it's light, it's fast. Its entire purpose is to be the American solution to European supercars, which the new Corvette generation is the answer to like European supercars. So I don't know, I like Corvettes. They're good looking. They're not super duper like stupidly expensive like exotic cars are, but you know, they have all that good old American muscle while being a sports car. But for like image and stuff, I really like muscle cars. There's nothing like a big intimidating muscle car with an even bigger intimidating V8.
Okay, all right. And then this one is funny because I like the show The Vikings. So not only did I like it, I had a couple of friends in Ireland that were in that show. So you said Vikings were not cool people.
They were not cool people.
So you're saying the show made it look like they were cool people?
Yes. I don't know. I didn't like the show. I liked the first season of the show, but really, I really think it's just another version of romanticizing Viking history, which, like, who were the Vikings? They were really just pirates. They're really, like, second sons, people who either were outlaws, which in Norse society is very bad. If you were kicked out of your village, you are worthless. Not as a human being, but according to their society, you are not a person. And then sons who were not heirs to, like, you know, their family's, like, fortune and stuff, like, all that sort of stuff. So Vikings were not like the cool people in society, in Norse society. Mm-hmm. It was nobility and the people who worked under the nobility, like freemen and stuff. While like the
right.
Vikings were pirates, they were dirty, they served under like sea kings and stuff. They were like the, we have like a modern conception of pirates, which is like, what would that be? 1700s pirates with cannons and stuff. Vikings are like
yeah.
the same thing. They're dirty, they're gross, they, you know, all, and like Viking warriors, like Norse war society, somewhat prominent, but like Viking warriors are not like as skilled as people make them out to be. Because
mm-hmm.
you're not very skilled when you go up to the peasant with no weapon and hack him up with an axe. Like, that's not skill. Like, any
right.
like any time like the Vikings face like resistance, well, what would they do? They take the gold and they run away. Simple as that.
Right.
You don't have to. You don't have to deal with an army when you're not there.
Right.
So
right.
I don't know. People
okay.
really romanticize like Norse culture as the Vikings and the wars, like the war gods and stuff. When the really and the important ones were gods like Freyr, who were like the fertility gods, and you know what
right.
was important to
mm-hmm.
Norse was food. To, like everyone
mm-hmm.
else, it was food. Like being able to eat.
Yeah.
Like they were farmers. They had. I feel like people boil down Norse society just down to like a really basic view of, oh, the Vikings and the warriors and stuff. And they were really much more than that. You know, they had a complex
mm-hmm.
culture, complex language. You know, they had shamans and a complex spirituality that was a little bit destroyed, but, you know, it made it through.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. People have a really basic view of Norse society, which is just the Vikings, which for me, it's annoying because you get people who are like big meatheads who like see my Thor's hammer and be like, poor Odin. And Odin's not a good god.
Okay.
He is not a good god at all. And I, you know, it's a little offensive sometimes, but you know.
Yeah, I have to laugh because, you know, it's same thing with me. People will say things and I'm in this group where people are going to other countries, and it's always amazing how people don't really do their research. And they're like,
oh,
oh
yeah.
I'm going here. And you're right. They do romanticize things a lot. And I'm thinking to myself, especially, for example, I have some friends that are moving to Africa, and I'm like, oh, that's good. I said, you do know that lions and stuff are like, they just roam freely, right? They don't they're not pinned up or anything, I'm just saying. Or, you know,
yeah,
I have a friend
that's how you get
who clapped. I have a friend who's in Australia who's always like, when are you going to come visit? I'm like, you guys have scary bugs. I'm never coming to Australia. I don't care if I, I said, you got scary creatures. And I said, everything is venomous. So when I think about how people make it sound like when they're going to go travel somewhere and they make it sound like, oh, my God, this is the greatest thing, in the back of my head, I'm like, yeah, I don't watch too much National Geographic. It's not like that. So.
Yeah, one of the things is, like, in my community, like the pagan community, a lot of people don't like Americans because of this
mm-hmm.
thing where, like, it's usually big meathead men who, like, just fall in love with the idea of dying in battle and stuff, which is not good. It's not a good thing. Like, literally and figuratively, it's not a good thing. And then they'll go to
right.
places like Iceland and just assume everyone there is, like, a Viking and, you know, like, they
right.
know their Viking heritage and history and stuff. And, you know, like, Icelanders do not like Americans for this reason.
Right.
It just rubs off the wrong way, you know?
Yeah. So the other thing is that I heard you didn't like tomatoes. Why?
They are red like the devil, and they taste nasty, and they get their nasty tomato juices over everything. Every time
okay.
I get a sandwich, I'm like, no tomatoes. And then if it has
uh-huh.
tomatoes on it, I'll remove the tomatoes, which, you know, that should solve the problem. It doesn't. Because they get their disgusting tomato juices all over the place, and they ruin everything else.
Okay.
They're a pollutant.
All right.
Hate tomatoes.
And,
but they're really good
and,
like, boiled down in this ketchup.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So, and give me one of your secrets about omelets.
Omelets?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy, I have a lot of secrets about omelets. I think one of the things is people... I tried to teach this person how to make an omelet, but it was, like, over text, not, like, over call or anything. So
right.
I'm, like, I give them the ingredients, I have them put it together, and they put it in the pan, and then they start stirring it until it becomes scrambled eggs, and I'm like, what are you doing? Let it cook. Like, there's two different kinds of omelets. There's an American and the French.
Right.
And, like, the American
right.
kind, you put it in, you let it sit there. Don't uh-huh. mess with it until it cooks through, and then you can fold it. Otherwise, you'll destroy it. And then the French omelet, that's the one you move because you stir it until it makes curds, and then
yes.
You let it cook through, and then you move it a lot. That's the one you move. But American omelets,
okay.
you let them sit, you let them cook, you let them brown. And then one of my favorite things to do is, like, when I put, like, ham and cheese in it, I
uh-huh.
put it in when it's still kind of, like, liquidy, so it kind of cooks into the egg. And then, of
okay.
course, spices. Spices is
right.
super important. All spices are good spices.
Okay. All right. So what college are, have you started college yet?
Yes, I am part of Ashworth College.
Okay.
Hopefully it's actually the name of my school. Hold on, let me double check. I'm working through the introduction class, and I feel
uh-huh.
as though I'm – my school's throwing shade, essentially. Like, there was one part of the class where it was, like, telling you how to write essays and stuff, and it was essentially,
mm-hmm.
if I remember correctly, it was something like write creatively or uniquely, and I'm like, I'm an author. I feel insulted right now. Like, this school is insulting me. Or, like, had me do, like, basic math. I was like, dang it.
Right.
But no, college is good. It's exactly this. It's from the same program. So my high school is the same program as this. So it's exactly
okay.
the same for me, which is really
oh.
a relief. It's like high school again.
Okay.
Except, you know.
And tell
bit.
Me, how do you like yeah. living in Austin compared to Colorado?
There's a lot more things to do here, and it's way hotter, which is good and bad. I mean, I can't be outside for very long, otherwise I'll bake and become a red lobster. But there's a
right.
lot more opportunity here. There's a lot more things to do. There's no snow,
mm-hmm.
so like half the year, the other half of the year, you can actually still do things. I like Austin. I like the jiu-jitsu community here for like my sport. I like the car community here because toll roads are extremely important to certain car communities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people can drive nice cars here, unlike in Colorado where the salt in the roads will rust out the bottom of your car.
Right.
And then, I don't know, it's just nice here. It's a good place
it's
to live.
Much,
a lot of opportunity, lots of things to do, you know.
Yeah, and it's a much younger type of a community as well. And
which
Austin
is good for
compared
me.
To, yeah, which is good for you. So that's why you would have so many more things to do there. I love Texas. It's just when I go to Texas, me, I love the weather. Being in Arizona, I think we really are people are like, Arizona, is it real hot? And I'm like, you guys don't understand how hot it is here. So anyway, when I'm in Texas, I'm like, it's cool weather to me when I'm in Texas. So I'm like, oh, my God, the weather's great here. They're like, it's hot. And I'm like, you got to go to Arizona if you think this is hot.
It's just humid here. It's like humid hot, which is a different kind of hot. But like Arizona, you can crack an egg on the road and it'll cook the egg. So that's,
you're
that's
right
hot.
About that. Yeah. Yeah, it is. Well, it's been great talking to you, E.T. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I'm really I'm excited about sharing the conversation with our readers and with our also on our magazine, which I'll send you a link once we edit and put it in there. But definitely I wish you the best for your book, for Forgive Us, and for Abandon Us. I look forward to be able to see Abandon Us, and maybe we'll be able to talk again when Abandon Us comes out. So looking forward, thank you so much for being on the program. It was really great.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm really excited for Abandon Us to come out. I'm really excited for the third book to come out, which is Remember Us, which is going to be
mm-hmm.
a little bit different from the first two books. It's going to be a little bit different. Really excited about that. I very much appreciate that you invited me onto the show. I just want to say one more thing, which is for
okay.
people listening, if you want to participate in a book drawing where you get like a free book shipped to you, you can go to my company's website, which is braggypress.com, BRAGI Press.com, all one word, no caps. You can go on there. You can sign up for the book drawing. You can get a free book.
Awesome. And we'll make sure that we put that link out as well. Thank you so much, E.T. Have a wonderful day, and good luck to you with everything. Make sure you come back and visit us and talk about your books, other books as well.
All right, I will. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you to our faithful listeners. This has been Living Vertical Radio, and you have been listening to our host, Cestine Duckworth. Stay tuned to our next program. Interested in getting your business in front of a worldwide audience? Contact info@verticalmediagroup.com. That's info@verticalmediagroup.com for details. And now, a word from our sponsors.
Books that make you laugh. Books that make you scream. Books that make you hope. And books that make you dream. What's on your bookshelf? Discover the books that make you who you are on booksthatmakeyou.com. Read book reviews. Meet the authors who pour their souls into the books you love. And enter to win bookish prizes. If you're a bibliophile, then Books That Make You is your new best friend. Visit booksthatmakeyou.com or find us on Insta and Facebook.